welcome you to the Holistic Health Show. I'm Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host. My first guest today is Dr. Susan Kolb, MD, FACS. Susan graduated from Johns Hopkins University and received her medical degree from Washington University School of Medicine. She completed postgraduate education in plastic and general surgery and has been certified by the American Board of Plastic Surgery since 1985. She is a founding diplomat of the American Board of Holistic Medicine, a member of the American Society of Plastic and Reconstructive Surgeons, the American Medical Association, and a fellow of the American College of Surgeons. Dr. Kolb has been in private practice in the Atlanta area since 1988 and is the founder of Plastico Surgery Center, a holistic surgery center that incorporates many disciplines of alternative medicine and spiritual healing. She hosts a weekly radio show, Temple of Health, every Saturday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. that offers a variety of informative topics on holistic and spiritual medicine. Her shows are available at www.bbsradio.com or www.plastico.com. Dr. Kolb is the founder of Millennium Healthcare and Avatar Cancer Center and is a recognized authority on energy healing and spiritual medicine and a leading plastic surgeon. She incorporates holistic, spiritual, traditional Chinese medicine and the teaching of ancient healers into her modern-day surgical practice. Susan is author of two books, The Naked Truth About Breast Implants, From Harm to Healing, and Goddess Shifts, Women Leaders for a Change. More information is available at www.thenakedtruthaboutbreastimplants.com. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Susan, and I look forward to hearing stories of women who use faith for healing from breast implants.
Thank you very much, Carl, for having me on.
Thank you, Susan, for coming. Now, what are the problems with silicone implants?
Well, actually, Carl, there's problems with both silicone and saline breast implants.
Mm-hmm.
Silicone gel is within the silastic or silicone shell in silicone implants, and saline or salt water is within the silicone shell of saline implants. And the problems of both implants extend from three kinds of toxicity, which can occur around any foreign body but tend to be more prevalent in breast implants. The first of these is a chemical toxicity, which usually doesn't occur until 8 to 10 years after or whenever the shell becomes incompetent and starts to leak the gel out.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes also the shell itself had some toxicities in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So the chemicals that would leak out are listed in the book, but there's about 30 of them. Many mm-hmm. of them are neurotoxins and carcinogens, methylethyl ketone, toluene, platinum, and other things used to make the implants that once they leak out can be very toxic, especially if the women don't have the good mechanisms within their liver and kidney to get rid of chemicals. And if you Google solvent toxicity, you'll see many of the same symptoms that the women have.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be for silicone gel implants.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, for both kinds of implants, a toxicity called silicone toxicity that occurs immediately upon putting anything with silicone in a body. And you might remember in medicine that many, many devices have silicone in them, from VP shunts to little plugs that they put in your tear ducts if you have dry eyes, to coatings around other prostheses. And so any, even testicular implants and penile implants, have silicone,
mm-hmm.
not gel, but the solid silicone. If you're a certain HLA or genetic type, specifically HLA, B27 or HLA-DR53. These are two that have been identified. Any silicone makes you very, very ill right away with an autoimmune type disease, probably based on your genetics. So these people just simply shouldn't have any silicone if possible.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a third kind of toxicity that occurs both in both kinds of implants, but is actually more pure in saline alone, and that's called biotoxicity. And you may have heard of sick building syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The mold, which is in the biofilm, there's a biofilm that's often got bacteria and mold and other fungi and viruses maybe that form around these implants in some patients, especially those with depressed immune systems, that they may have, you know, problems with biotoxins that get that are very tiny molecules. You can't measure them in the blood, but you can detect them on something called a visual contrast sensitivity test. So if a woman has an infected left breast implant but a non-infected right breast implant, her eye test on the left will be abnormal, but on the right will be normal.
Mm-hmm.
So these tiny, tiny little biotoxins disrupt via the hypothalamus. They disrupt the endocrine system, and I'm talking adrenal insufficiency, sex hormone insufficiency, something called ADH, which is antidiuretic. Mm-hmm. Women drink and pee all the time because they can't hold on to water, even though they don't have diabetes. And they also have problems with sleep hormones. They can't sleep because there's a decreased level of melatonin. And they also have the thyroid deficiency that may not show up on the normal thyroid test, but nonetheless they have the symptoms of the hair falling out and
mm-hmm.
all the other symptoms, and they do better if you put them on a small amount of thyroid hormone.
Mm-hmm.
So it disrupts the endocrine system, it disrupts the neurological system, and the neurological symptoms stay on the same side. They get tingling, they get numbness, they get muscular weakness. Many of the women have come to me in wheelchairs. They get cognitive dysfunction. They end up with a number of neurological problems that are pretty severe.
Mm-hmm.
And then their immune system's affected. You may have heard of fibromyalgia.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's primarily biotoxicity with some chemical toxicity thrown in some cases, because chemicals do similar things depending on the chemical exposure. But many patients with fibromyalgia have a biotoxicity basis for it. And the old-time doctors used to recommend that people retire to Arizona or
mm-hmm.
another desert environment. And, of course, they get much better there because they didn't have the mold exposure
mm-hmm.
in the environment. So the sick building is when there's biotoxins in the air and you're breathing them in. You
mm-hmm.
don't necessarily have mold in your body, but you're breathing the biotoxins in usually through the air conditioning system. But my women have the sick building inside their chest wall.
Mm-hmm.
So if they go on vacation for 10 days, they don't get better. You see,
oh.
I've had women with breast implants come to me wondering if they were sick from their implants, and I just say, well, go on vacation for 7 to 10 days, and if you get better, it's your house,
mm-hmm.
you see.
Mm-hmm.
And then we don't have to remove your breast implant.
Mm-hmm.
So, but certainly all women with breast implants need to avoid moldy or moist environments like beach homes, you know, old houses. After Rita and Katrina, a number of women got deathly ill when they came back from the evacuation and slept on moldy mattresses and infected their breast implants.
Oh.
So you breathe the mold in or you breathe the biotoxins in, and the immune system goes down, and then the biofilm goes up, and you get these toxicities.
Mm-hmm.
So much of what I've told you
mm-hmm.
is in the literature. It just isn't put together like I've put it together in the
mm-hmm.
book.
Mm-hmm.
I basically put this together because I saw over 1,000 women with these conditions, and at first I didn't distinguish between the three different kinds of toxicities, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But finally I figured it out, because after the breast implants were taken off the market in the early 90s, we started putting a lot of saline implants.
Mm-hmm.
So it took a while, 10 years, for those to start to get infected, because they had a valve issues about 10 years out, or sooner if you had a car wreck or other chest wall trauma. The implant wouldn't deflate, but the valve would get cracked or somehow compromised, and then stuff would start growing in and around the implant, and then the women would get ill. And we actually grow mold out. And it's actually in the literature. Mm-hmm. Mold grows out in the implant as well as around the implant. So it's there's not like a, you know, this isn't theory. This is actually proven with mm-hmm. with laboratory data. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, many, many doctors are telling their patients that saline implants can't make them sick, even though, you know, in the medical literature, it's obvious that it can, mm-hmm. and they just aren't reading the literature.
Mm-hmm. So why don't they then know about the problems? Is it besides
I think it's economic. I think for plastic surgeons, it's economic. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't want to acknowledge the science of biofilms. There's actually a book out on biofilms now, mm-hmm. A scientific reference on it. And there's a lot of information that in a biofilm, which forms around a foreign body, it's very, very resistant to traditional therapy. Although you can, you know, treat them with all the different antibiotics and antifungals, when you stop the treatment, the infection or the symptoms come back. Mm-hmm. And also, it's not like a normal infection where you get redness, swelling, you know, tenderness. Well, you have tenderness, but you don't get mm-hmm. redness and swelling and elevated white count in most patients. So the doctors just simply don't know how to diagnose the problem, and they're reluctant to treat the problem because they don't understand the problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you mm-hmm. don't know what you're treating, and your society doesn't support the idea of this being a problem, which the society has not supported it so far, despite the literature showing that the problem exists, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. And the other thing about silicone, you may have remembered in the 90s, you know, they did quite a public relations campaign. Mm-hmm. The chemical industry did quite a public relations campaign to try to convince all the doctors that these women weren't sick from their implants. They were just greedy or you know, they all had attorneys and they just wanted money. And so a lot of the doctors watch the evening news rather than mm-hmm. read mm-hmm. the medical literature. And what people don't understand, there's two glaring examples of what's wrong with this. In the mid-90s, Dr. Andrew Campbell and other editors put out a International Journal of Toxicology just on silicone mm-hmm. toxicity. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's a whole journal devoted to silicone toxicity. And, of course, no plastic surgeon I've ever met knows about that. Mm-hmm. The other problem is that the FDA did a study that was published in the Journal of Rheumatology in, I think, November 2001, and it partially funded this study whereby they looked at women who'd had ruptured implants. And this study is important because all the other studies were done by indirectly funded by, most likely indirectly funded by the people working, at least in part, for the chemical companies mm-hmm. or working at institutions that were endowed by the chemical companies. These are the Harvard, Mayo, and Duke studies. Mm-hmm. And they kind of didn't do very good studies. They did epidemiology studies, and you can't do an epidemiology study based on a disease that hasn't been characterized. And they kind of knew that. And so there was a panel at the NIH that looked at all these studies and declared them flawed and said they had to be repeated. But, of course, that never made the evening news. So the plastic surgeons are always quoting these studies that are inherently flawed, and I think deliberately inherently flawed. Mm-hmm. I think that the chemical company influenced these studies so that they could put them on the evening news and convince all the medical people that the silicone was totally, you know, just women trying to get money. Mm-hmm. That's what I believe. But anyway, back to this study. It was the only study that looked at ruptured patients. Mm-hmm. And ruptured patients obviously have the chemical exposure, because that's silicone. It's illegal to inject silicone in the body in the U.S. So mm-hmm. why is it okay to have it running through the system once the implant ruptures? You know, mm-hmm. you have to ask yourself that question. But anyway, the study showed that these women had a high level of fibromyalgia. And what's interesting is that study was still up on the FDA website in 2006 when mm-hmm. the FDA put silicone back on the market. Mm. And you have to ask yourself, is that crazy or what? Now, I don't know if you've seen the new Time magazine that's out this week. One of the stories is the FDA on drugs. This is really great. So the FDA is having all sorts of problems right now. And there were 9 research scientists in the FDA that blew the whistle on the FDA, mm-hmm. saying that it did not follow science. And silicone was one of these along with other drugs. They gave all these examples where science was not followed, but politics was instead. And this was presented to Obama's people. And I don't know what has happened since then, but obviously the FDA, because of whistleblowers within its own ranks, is being challenged to do what's right rather than what is being paid for.
Right, right. Well, Susan, how can women then regain their health after having implants?
They need to do a few things. The most important thing is to get the implant and all of the capsule out because as long as you've got that in there, the biofilm is not readily treatable. It can be, symptoms can be controlled in the case of saline, but not in the case of silicone. You don't want to wait very long because it travels to all parts of the body via the macrophage and lymphatic system, and carcinogens are traveling throughout the body, so you definitely don't want that. And peer-reviewed studies show an increased level of all sorts of cancers other than breast cancer. Breast cancer is actually fourfold less, but many other cancers are increased. So you don't want to wait. Once that implant starts to leak, and it doesn't have to rupture, once it leaks, you start getting the problems. And the majority of implants leak between 8 and 15 years. The newer implants, at least I believe one company's implant leaks it leaks right away. So the women are getting sick at 1 to 3 years rather than the normal 8 to 15 years. I got sick about 9 years when mine started to leak. Fortunately, mine didn't rupture. So you have to get them out. You have to get the capsule out. You have to get any lymph nodes that are filled with silicone out because they're not functioning. Usually that's just 1 or 2 per side. And textured implants by one company have been shown to have a higher rate of lymphoma. So even a textured saline implant, if it's a particular company, needs to, I believe those lymph nodes need to come out because we see evidence of the silicone texturing flaking off and getting into the lymph nodes. And so we have to get whatever's causing that lymphoma out of there. It probably is a physical agent that is causing it, although we don't know for sure, but because it's only one company's textured implant that seems to be involved, it probably is a chemical agent. So that's important. And then around the time of surgery, most plastic surgeons don't know this, but it's very important not just to treat the bacterial infection, but also the fungal infection. So antifungals are very, very important, as are other methods to control any other infections that the patient may have. And around the time of surgery, it's also very important to have the immune system bolstered up with immune supplements, and that's where holistic medicine comes in. And as you know, we've talked before about holistic medicine, and that's it doesn't affect just one system. It affects many systems, so therefore the treatment has to be multi, dimensional in that sense. These women also have a great deal of anger and a great deal of resentment that their lives were, essentially stolen from them because of false advertising and a medical profession that refuses to take responsibility for what it's created. So you have to deal with the psychological aspects as well. And then the last treatment is detoxification. I have chemical detox, silicone detox, and biotoxin detox. And each of these, so you have to determine what percentage of the toxicity is due from each of these and design a, we design a program for each patient really based on their immune system, their neurological system, and their endocrine system. And along with this, sometimes we have to do adrenal support, sometimes CORTEF or adrenal support. And other, even I've even had to, if women are getting up 7 and 8 times at night to urinate, I even have to give them intranasal desmopressin, which is ADH, so that they can get some sleep. Because you can imagine if you're getting up that that many times, you don't sleep, and if you don't sleep, you don't heal. So it's truly a holistic thing. And most surgeons just simply aren't educated or interested in that level of dedication to a patient. And I'm also very good at getting insurance coverage, if possible, for the explantation. Unless the exclusion page on their insurance policy says that complications of cosmetic surgery are excluded, we generally can get medical necessity coverage for the explant. I have a great, I have a great deal of literature. It's listed in the book that medical directors will pay attention to. And It's interesting. I've interviewed quite a few, or I've talked to quite a few medical directors whose women that they know, or in some cases ex-wives, were sick with silicone disease. And when I tell them all about this disease, they get very quiet because they realize that they judged the woman incorrectly and didn't help her.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting to see the. And once you present them with the scientific information, they realize that they did wrong by their mm-hmm. their ex-wife or another woman in their life that was sick mm-hmm. that they just thought was just not right. Or mm-hmm. I think some of them even been put in mental institutions.
Oh.
So it's very, very sad. But, you know, women's health has always been a struggle. You know, mm-hmm. many male physicians attribute any symptom the woman has to menopause or hormones or hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
And the male medical societies, and not society so much, but the male medical model has been to, you know, to try to be more dismissive of women. And I think they're trying to change that now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing some CMEs now, and there's a lot more information, at least on Medscape and some of the other thing, mm-hmm. about how important it is to really listen to the women and validate what they're telling you rather than to dismiss what they're saying.
Right.
So hopefully women will mm-hmm. be able to get better health care mm-hmm. in the future once this kind of thing comes out.
Mm-hmm. Now, Susan, you talk about women in your book who use faith as part of their recovery from the diseases that resulted. Can you tell us about some of the women?
Yes. I want to start off by saying that most of the women who come to me via a faith-based mechanism or interest,
mm-hmm.
or a faith-based interest in somebody close to them.
Mm-hmm.
A number of my women are highly intuitive and actually were guided to get up, often in the middle of the night. It's very interesting. Around 3 in the morning, our intuition can be a lot better mm-hmm. than during the day when we have all these distractions. And they're guided to Google certain things on the Internet that, until this book was published, was the only way you could really get to me, was either word of mouth or through the Internet. And so their intuition is what gets them to me. But usually they relate to me that they've been praying before that for an
mm-hmm.
answer.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I think it's important that we ask our higher power or our connection to that higher power to help us with problems.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't know all of the solutions out there for any particular problem, whereas God or consciousness or the Holy Spirit or whatever you want to call it
mm-hmm.
has a lot more information than we do. There was a story that I've related in the book just to illustrate this. This was actually a story that was on Vanity Insanity and in Glamour magazine. There was a patient of mine named Catherine who had a new baby, and she was breastfeeding, and she got mastitis, or infection of the breast, which mm-hmm. is common breastfeeding. And her insurance, her HMO, put her on a high dose of antibiotics without antifungals, and she got a massive fungal infection in her saline implant, and which was mm-hmm. above the muscle, so it was very easy mm-hmm. to get infected. And she got very, very deathly ill, and her husband and the doctors and nobody would validate her. And so it got more and more frustrating. She couldn't take care of her child. She was deathly ill. And so she decided to kill herself one night. But she decided to sleep on it. And mm-hmm. during the night, she had a dream. And in the dream, she was told that it was her breast implants that were making her sick.
Mm-hmm.
And the next morning she called me, and we got her well pretty quickly, you
mm-hmm.
know, because she had a black implant full of mold.
Oh.
And it was actually her holding it up was in Glamour magazine. So
mm-hmm.
she has done a lot to educate people. And I wanted to relay one of my interesting stories. It's an FDA research scientist,
mm-hmm.
who female, who got breast implants. And she thought, because she was an FDA research scientist, she had researched everything, and saline implants were safe.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was she got ill right away. And when she called me, she was a research scientist, so she researched it and and found me. And when she called me, I told her that she was most likely HLA-B27, and she had it tested, and she was.
Mm-hmm.
so her story is in there about how, even though she had all of this information and knowledge and everything, she still fell as a victim to this, not knowing that it was a possibility. Mm-hmm. So that shows you how hidden the information really mm-hmm. is. It's not, you know, it's even research scientists aren't able to determine everything. Mm-hmm. And there's 8 patient stories in the book, and I believe the majority of them mention that they were spiritually guided mm-hmm. in some form or another. Sometimes it's a family member, because the person's so sick that they don't really, you know, they're not really able to do the research. Usually it's them praying for help and then mm-hmm. being guided either through a friend, a family member, or themselves on the internet to mm-hmm. find me. Or mm-hmm. even one of my patients met somebody in line at the pharmacy, mm-hmm. Which was interesting. Mm-hmm. And she was telling her about her problems, and the lady told her to come to me. Mm-hmm. So you can run into somebody even in a drugstore,
right.
You know.
Right.
If they're local. Mm-hmm. But we have patients from all over the world. I think I've had patients from as far away as New Zealand and Europe and the Philippines and just all over, mm-hmm. a lot from Canada. And what I'm hoping is that we can show the people running the insurance companies that are excluding this from their patients that their health benefits are so great compared mm-hmm. to the cost of the surgery, because these women spend hundreds of thousands of dollars. Mm. And if they happen to be insured, that's hundreds of thousands of dollars in the insurance company's money. Mm-hmm. And really, an explantation is usually anywhere between $6,000 and $8,000, depending on the length of time, and sometimes even less if it's very quick. It can take anywhere from an hour to mm-hmm. even 5 hours, depending on if it's very, very difficult. So, mm-hmm. or an anesthesia based on time, so that accounts for the difference in cost. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there are so many women out there who are ill from their implants, and not all of them have chest wall symptoms. Some of them just have the systemic symptoms, like fatigue, muscle aches, joint aches, balance problems, periodontal disease. Just there's a whole list in the book of things that are affected mm-hmm. depending on the kind of toxicity that you have. Mm-hmm. But I would say with any chronic illness or with any chronic problem that you have in your life, it's extremely important to go ahead and pray for help mm-hmm. or ask for help. Mm-hmm. I think there's a spiritual law that says, ask and you shall receive. Mm-hmm. And I think it's one that we need to emphasize to our listeners, that there's very little out there that can't be solved. Mm-hmm. You may not know how. And if you have enough negative thinking, you may actually block the answer
right.
from coming to you.
Mm-hmm.
But if you sincerely ask for help and leave it open-ended, that's what I always do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't presume to know how this help is going to come. I just leave it open-ended and express my desire to have help with a particular problem and do it in a prayerful way. And then I watch and see what comes forth. Mm-hmm. You have to also recognize help when it comes forth.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you see as the future for breast implants?
Well, they're trying to develop breast implants that have less problems, but I think that's going to be difficult to do, given that silicone is really the best thing that we've found.
Mm-hmm.
The future of breast implants probably is not the implant. It's probably stem cell mm-hmm. and fat combined. In other words, taking the woman's own fat mm-hmm. and adding the stem cell technology. It's not yet FDA approved in the U.S. The company, Cytori, is waiting for the FDA to approve their European trials.
Mm-hmm.
If they are not approved, then they'll have to do the trials here in the U.S. So stem cell research and making sure that stem cells are safe, that they don't cause cancer, that's very important. And then doing sterile injections of this solution or technology.
Mm-hmm.
And probably we could get maybe 1 to 1.5 cup size. Now, if you've got a breast cancer situation where you've had a breast removed, you'll probably have to go with, you know, more what we call autogenous tissue, which is tissue from other parts of the body
mm-hmm.
brought up to the chest wall rather than the implant, because those implants tend to be 500 to 700 cc's, and
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that mm-hmm. tissue engineering is going to get there anytime soon. Mm-hmm. Maybe eventually they'll be able to grow a breast in something else and transfer it in, mm-hmm. but you know that's not able to be done right now.
Right. Now, Susan, would you tell us then about your books and services and how the listeners can reach you?
Sure. If you go to www.thenakedtruthaboutbreastimplants, I actually have two books there. One is The Naked Truth About Breast Implants, From Harm to Healing, and this is a book I published late last year on the eight women's stories and all of the science and what the disease is about. On the same site, you can look at Goddess Shift, Women Leading for a Change, and that's a compilation work of 42 authors, including Jane Fonda, Shirley MacLaine, Barbara Walters, Angelina Jolie, Madonna, Oprah, Michelle Obama, and J.K. Rowling. J.K. Rowling has a interesting chapter called The Power of Persistence. Evidently, her first Harry Potter book was rejected at least 50 mm-hmm. times. So there's another spiritual lesson for you, is the mm-hmm. power of persistence. You know, you have to keep having faith and having keep up the persistence. And look where she is now. Imagine if she had given up. So, I mean, think about that. That's really amazing. And Oprah has a great chapter in there as well. So that's kind of where people can get the book. My practice website is www.templeofhealth.ws. And in it is three sites. One is a cancer treatment center, one is a plastic surgery center, and one is an integrative medical center called Millennium Healthcare. In the plastic surgery center, we have our own operating rooms, MD anesthesia, JACO certification, and we tend to do really fairly complex operations there in the center, where it's, I believe it's much safer than in the hospitals these days.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you very much, Susan. This was very informative, and I know it will be well received by the women listening. And I hope that as a result of this, they will know where they can go and what they can read to solve their problems.
Well, thank you, Carl, for having me on. I've enjoyed it as well.
Great. Thank you, Susan. And now a word from our sponsor, A Distinctive Style magazine at www.adistinctivestyle.com. This magazine is identified as an art-loving, earth-conscious, inspirational community that reports on eco-products and awareness, art and artisans, celebrities making a difference in the world, charities and inspirational stories, and you won't be disappointed. The upcoming issue is again full of wonderful articles. The cover story is with Colin Firth and how he perceived the stuttering part of himself as he played the king in his Oscar-winning role in The King's Speech. Jane Fraser, founder of the Stuttering Association, was also interviewed for this piece. There are lots of articles and videos about autism and how it affects the outer world. Children are bullied and stared at because of their condition, and we're letting people know what it's like to be on the inside of the autistic child. Our goal is to help eliminate the judging of others. There is also an interview with Derek Paravicini, musical savant who can recall every song he's ever heard, and Dr. Adam Oakleford, who has taken Derek on as a full-time friend and who is a professor of music in London. These are a few of the stories you will read in the upcoming issue of A Distinctive Style magazine, and I know you will want to subscribe. For more information and to subscribe, go to www.adistinctivestyle.com. My second guest is Dr. Jean Ang, who has a PhD and a healing practice in Thousand Oaks, California, where he utilizes several therapies with clients, including pranic healing, reconnective healing, the reconnection shamanistic healing, vortex healing, and the 12 blueprint accelerating the evolution of the human energy field. In addition, he teaches seminars that focus on science, spirituality, and healing, and travels throughout the United States facilitating healing sessions and workshops. Gene was formally trained as a neurobiologist at Yale University, where he earned his doctorate in basic mechanisms of how the brain develops, followed by a postdoctorate fellowship on how ultrasound can affect the developing cerebral cortex. After finishing school, he decided to step into the role of a facilitator of healing in order to help people through direct interactions. Most of his work centers around the use of subtle energy to align the subtle energy body, its channels, meridians, and energy centers to restore balance and harmony so that healing can occur, whether physical, emotional, mental, or spiritual. More information is available at www.geneang.com. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Gene, and I look forward to hearing about energy healing. Now first, can you tell us how you went from science to energy healing?
Yes, and thank you, Carl, for inviting me to speak. I'm very honored.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I was. It was around the time of I was doing my postdoctoral fellowship after I had finished my PhD at Yale, and I had actually met a Russian healer who was in Brighton Beach, which is in Brooklyn, and I began learning from him energy healing from the Russian perspective, and they have a lot of energy healers there, where he told me that the kind of state science had done a lot of research on energy healing and psychic phenomena. So he was one of the, you know, sort of expert subjects that they had studied. Anyways, he sort of initiated me into the energy healing world. And we trained for about 6 months together. And then I studied a number of other different energy healing modalities, some more formalized here in the United States. One of them was called pranic healing, and another one called the reconnection. And then right around when I was deciding between continuing in academia or going full-time as a healer, I decided to choose the latter. And so that was kind of how the transition worked. So it occurred over about a three-year period.
And do the Russians do healing differently than what is usually done in the United States?
I would say it's very advanced. I don't know, the universal principles are probably there, and there's probably some things that we don't, at least publicly here in the United States, know about yet that they're doing. They called it bioenergy. That was just a term that they were currently using. And a lot of it stemmed from their shamanic and also folklore practices, as well as just a number of talented healers being born in that sort of country. So I would say there's probably some techniques that we just aren't aware of in the West that may have not been sort of publicly taught yet.
It's interesting because back probably in the 70s maybe, they were much further ahead as far as psychic things also. And I remember a book that came out called Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain. And they were doing all kinds of research on people's psychic ability and its influence on the environment and on plants and all kinds of things. And so they seem to have been much further ahead than we were at that point in that field also.
Yes. The name of my teacher, his name was Vladimir Maximov. And one of the things that he would always do is we would go to the ocean and swim in the ocean before we started any exercises. And I guess that was the way that they recharged themselves every day. But this was in Siberia. And so he showed me a video where he basically was swimming in the ice water every day.
How do you define, or what does healing mean to you?
Well, I think there's many levels to healing. I think one of the, when we hear about healing, one of the sort of direct levels is a decrease or elimination of symptoms. So I think that would be one level. Another level would be sort of bringing balance back to the person.
Mm-hmm.
And that may or may not lead to symptoms being decreased right away or being self-evident.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think a third level may be what I would call a deeper connection with one's soul or spirit or some connection to God or some higher power or a belief in and direct experience with the interconnectedness of life. So people use different words for that, but all of those encompass different levels of human.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you mentioned that the rebalancing might not show a change immediately, because I find the same with herbs and supplements and a lot of the other natural things, is that people are so used to drugs that are so harsh on the body, and they tend to bring a quicker resolution of the problems, but they also bring so many side effects and everything, whereas the natural things, they may take a little bit longer, but then you don't have side effects, and you tend to more often have a lasting healing of whatever the problem was.
Right, exactly.
Now, you mentioned different types of healing that you do, the reconnective and the pranic and all. Do you favor one over the other, or do you use a combination, or, you know, what is your preference when you use these healing techniques?
Right, yeah. Basically, when I do a session, I'll limit it to whatever particular modality a person sort of decided with a client beforehand. I rarely will mix the different modalities,
even
though
don't.
All of them are what would be considered energy healing modality.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say I do a lot of reconnective healing, a lot of reconnections. I also do the pranic healing.
Mm-hmm.
And another energy healing modality called vortex healing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all slightly different in the sense that they may have a different philosophy about healing. They may use slightly different techniques. And those are usually one of intention of how the healer is using the energy.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say it'd be a balance between those three modalities.
Mm-hmm. Now, will these work for physical and mental problems?
Yes, all three, the vortex healing, pranic healing, and reconnective healing can address physical as well as emotional and mental, and even if you'd call spiritual issues.
Mm-hmm.
So some sort of work better with certain people just because after they hear about the modality, they may feel more akin or sort of resonate more with one particular modality over the other one.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I feel when a person comes in, there might be one that seems more appropriate to work with.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us the types of conditions that you have worked with and had success with?
Mm-hmm. I'll start with the reconnection, which the reconnection is the name of the overarching modality, and it really has two offerings. One is called reconnective healing. The other one is called the reconnection, same as the name of the modality. And I was drawn to that modality particularly for because of that second offering called the reconnection. And the difference between the two offerings is reconnective healing is you would do for anyone who requested or wanted some type of healing on whatever level, whether that be physical, emotional, or mental, or spiritual, like you mentioned. And then the reconnection is meant more for sort of life path acceleration or life path alignment or just becoming more attuned to one's sort of higher purpose or higher soul's purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And I do quite a lot of the reconnection. So people will usually come in feeling that, you know, they can sort of get on track. They want to move forward a little faster. And sometimes it's described as a bit like a quantum upgrade in one's operating system, in the computer analogy. So I've seen really good success with people with that, and found that in my own life when I got that done, that that was one of the things that helped me to move into the sort of healing world, coming from the science world, where the shift was quite dramatic in terms of just the mindset and overarching paradigms being used by those two different groups. So I found a lot of people have really benefited from that. often.
Now, are these more than for wellness than for illness?
Yeah, I think one way of looking at the energy healing modalities in general is from a paradigm, sort of a healthcare paradigm of wellness,
mm-hmm.
rather than curing illness.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where their fort or their strength is.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
rather than coming at a point in time when one may be, you know, very either physically sick, although they're still helpful,
mm-hmm.
They're also very beneficial when one feels very normal but wants to kind of continue on that wellness path.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it can be very beneficial in that case also.
Then, Gene, is there a faith component in this type of healing?
Mm-hmm. Depends on the modality. They may suggest or teach during their training that they found that faith, or what I might use as another term called receptivity,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Can be helpful in terms of the client receiving the full benefit of the healing. In particular, you know, in a diametrically opposed way, pranic healing mentions that receptivity is pretty crucial to that particular healing modality's effect. So a person who might come in, and even though they would like externally have said that they would like a healing, or maybe they were forced to come in mm-hmm. some ways,
mm-hmm.
they may not receive the energy, and
mm-hmm.
the healer can sometimes feel that as kind of like a pushing back of the energy.
Mm-hmm.
The other modality that would probably suggest otherwise is reconnective healing, in which the person, a client coming in for that type of healing, for whatever reason, perhaps because of the type of energy or frequency, doesn't necessarily need to be, you know, in a state of 100% receptivity to receive the benefit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, Gene, could you give us an example of someone that has come in and why they came in and what happened and how they felt at the end?
Mm-hmm. So a more sort of dramatic case in terms of just an external manifestation of healing was a mother brought in her young son who had what are called petite mal seizures.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just seizures that a child may go, this usually affects children, where they sort of just phase out for a couple seconds and they're having the seizure, and then they'll just come back to consciousness. And they may have anywhere between, you know, 50 to hundreds of these during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be quite debilitating in terms of being able to concentrate during school. So she came in and we did a number of reconnective healings. And after the first one, she told me he basically went down to somewhere between 50, starting off at 50 to 75 of these seizures per day, down to 20.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the second and third, he was really down to maybe a few,
mm-hmm.
two or three a day.
Great.
So mm-hmm. that was a, you know, very dramatic change.
Mm-hmm. Now, was this a lasting change?
Yeah, with reconnective healing, really the maximum number of healings are three.
Mm-hmm.
So after three healings, those particular energies or frequencies stay with the mm-hmm. client or the person. So we really didn't continue after the three, and he pretty much stabilized.
Great. Mm-hmm. Then where do you think that energy healing is going in the future?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because in the integrative medical model that's, you know, sort of becoming more well-known in the medical universities, and many of the major medical universities have departments that are integrative.
Mm-hmm.
Really what's needed is sort of evidence-based medicine, which basically just are studies that are showing, you know, an effect from these different integrative medical modalities, and one of those being energy healing,
mm-hmm.
and, for example, other ones being, like you mentioned, herbs or acupuncture or meditation, or, you know, Chinese yoga like Qigong or yoga. So I think in the future, as maybe researchers become interested in the energy paradigm, which could come sooner rather than later, those types of studies will come out. And I think from the traditional medical model, when those studies have been done, then energy healing will be sort of more widely accepted within that model. But that being said, I think there's a lot of people who are just interested in energy healing who, you know, will go sort of on their own to either find practitioners or study some aspect of energy healing. So I think that will continue because they feel internally or they've seen in themselves or relatives or friends some dramatic change or some change that wouldn't be recorded by a study, sort of those other two levels of healing that I was mentioning, the balance and sort of the soul connection. And, you know, those are sort of perhaps more longer-lasting effects that I think energy healing will have for sort of the greater public. And that won't necessarily depend on whether energy healing is accepted into the integrative medical model.
Then, Gene, is there anything else you'd like to say before we look at your workshops and seminars and how the listeners could reach you?
Oh, no, I guess just that if people, you know, who may be listening, some may already have done some type of energy healing work, or others who are just curious to learn about it. I think there are a number of, you know, very well grounded and sort of high integrity practices out there. So I think, you know, it'd be, if they're open to it, it'd be a good experience to try.
Then, Gene, would you tell us about your practice and your workshops, seminars, anything else that you would like to tell us about and how listeners could reach you?
Oh, sure. People can see the workshops and seminars and healing offerings that I have at my website. It's www.geneang.com. That's GeneAng.com. And I have a number of workshops and retreats, and the ones that are upcoming are in Sedona in April. And then in August, there is a three-day retreat in Mount Shasta, and then another three-day retreat in Sedona in November to celebrate the 11-11-11 date. And for the healing practices, which is what I'm spending most of my daily time doing, they're usually hourly sessions, and I work out of an integrative medical office here in actually it's called Westlake Village is the name of the city. It's in Thousand Oaks, California, and that's near Los Angeles. And then about once a month I travel to the east and work in Connecticut and also in Pennsylvania in Doylestown, which is right outside Philadelphia. So most of the information and descriptions of the healing modalities can be found on the website.
Well, this is great because it's not always that we have scientists that then will talk about things that people tend to think are not scientific. So I think this has been very interesting, and I appreciate it very much, Gene.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
Thank you. I thank you for joining me today on the Holistic Health Show. I hope you have heard something of value to you. I also invite you to my website, www.holistichealthshow.com, where you'll find all shows for the past 3 years that are available for listening. You will also find a form to sign up for the free monthly Healthy Holistic Aging newsletter to be emailed to you. You can also contact me if you have comments about the show or ideas for future shows. You'll also find my last book for sale titled Healthy Holistic Aging that tells you how to remain healthy into your older years so you can avoid disabilities, illnesses, and medications as I have done. In the store, you will also find a few ebooks and one CD on smoking cessations. Others will be added eventually. I am Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host, wishing you a great week.